You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more. Today on our show, we're talking with Emily Trice. Emily, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much.
So, Emily, I know you're doing a lot of things, but why don't we talk about what you're working on now, and you can give us a little introduction to the things you're working on, because I know you have a number of things going on.
Yeah, I think the most exciting thing is Twyla, which is this new art tech startup. So I'm currently one of their head curators. It's based in Austin, Texas. I, however, live at the moment in Pittsburgh due to family reasons, but through my work with Twyla, I travel frequently to Berlin and New York, Los Angeles. I meet with artists, and the platform that Twyla is providing, it's really new, it's exciting. Essentially, it's keeping up with technology because often in the gallery world, a little behind the times in terms of technology. So we're doing limited editions, and we're providing essentially like the world's largest dispersed gallery because we have access to walls either through our partners who are, you know, luxury property owners or boutique and luxury hotels. So in many ways that, you know, a company like Uber is the largest taxi company and it owns no taxis, we are hoping to become the largest physical gallery for limited editions by contemporary artists, even though the walls aren't necessarily walls that we own.
So is that, I mean, how is that different from, so you're making limited editions, are most of these works on paper?
Exactly. At the moment, we are focused because we haven't even launched yet. We're still in beta, so we're building this as we go from the ground up, and it's really interesting to be the architect of this kind of company because it's not really existing in the art world yet. So being sort of like the catalyst for a new way to interact with contemporary art, putting art in context in front of hopefully, you know, a burgeoning audience of you know, ambitious future collectors, it's great because I get to provide a lot of exposure to artists that, you know, I'm familiar with through having lived in Berlin, lived in New York, you know, even places like Aspen. So it's wonderful because this way I can sort of broaden their exposure and provide them like a new platform to show their work.
So tell me a little bit about what happens as you travel around Europe, because it hasn't started yet. When do you plan to, does it plan to launch? Does Twyla plan to launch?
We are hoping to launch essentially during South by Southwest this year, so it's coming up quite soon. It's in only a few weeks, and since Austin is essentially our HQ and it's where we're based, you know, it's an exciting sort of event space for us to participate in and collaborate with. So there are some like things that I'm not sure if we're actually allowed to talk about them yet, but we should be able to sort of, you know, promote them very soon within like the next week and a half. So, but it's great because, you know, I'm very much into sort of like, you know, the democracy of, like, an art world, because at the moment, very much reflecting this sort of income inequality where, like, the art world is really working out for, like, the 1% of artists, the 1% of galleries. Having worked at Gagosian, I've seen it firsthand. And, you know, this is the way to kind of level the playing field a little bit. So we're working with everything from mural, graffiti, stencil street artists to very conceptual, you know, highbrow German artists, and we have Guy Dill on the platform. He's this wonderful West Coast sculptor, you know, who's like tied with Rauschenberg and those boys back in the day. So it's just great because it's very inclusive. So we like to include, not exclude.
That's cool. And so it'll be an online platform where artists by invitation can sell multiple editions. And will you be active in, or the company be active in reaching out to places? In other words, like an art consultancy, you're kind of consulting with collectors all the time, but will it be like that, or will it be kind of like an online store where people can just go and, or an online gallery rather, where people can just go and purchase prints right online?
They can certainly do that, but our ambition is to essentially bridge the digital and the physical world. And so for us, that's why the Art in Context program is so important. And so our partnerships, for example, there's this wonderful boutique hotel, South Congress in Austin. That'll be like an initial flagship property where you can see our editions installed. They have these very sort of sleek and sexy wall tags that give you a code. So you can link to the edition digitally through your smartphone. It's essentially leveraging new smartphone technology in order to provide a new scale platform for artists, because otherwise, you know, many artists, their work is seen. Let's say they have a gallery and they're exclusive. They have two shows, you know, maybe with this gallery in two locations every year. So their work is only on, like, certain walls, we'll say, like, I don't know, 12 weeks a year. This way they can be on walls all throughout the year, all over the country and eventually internationally, you know, and in front of this, you know, emerging generation of art enthusiasts and future collectors. So it's our hope to give those people also an entry, an access point to acquire contemporary art, essentially a price point that they're comfortable with, so that in the future, you know, they can go and buy, you know, $20,000-$30,000 piece of work from one of the artists they've been following along, you know, when they were first engaged in a context in which they're already comfortable. Just because the gallery can be a little intimidating, the art fair can be a little daunting, it's a lot of information, it's very distracting. So this way, you know, we put art in a context where this particular demographic is already comfortable.
And is it anything like, I don't know, if I haven't looked at them in a while, but Jen Beekman's project, 20 by 200?
I would say the philosophies are quite aligned. It's just that the methodology of distribution is different.
So tell me how it would be different. So the methodology of distribution would be, would look very different or would be curated in a different way?
Well, no, essentially, it's just because through our partnerships, well, let me start at the beginning. So our founder is a man named Brian Sharples. Brian Sharples also founded a company called Home Away. Home Away is essentially a very upmarket Airbnb-type firm. So instead of getting a room, like with Airbnb, through Home Away, you can get, like, this magical villa. You know, it's this luxury destination. There are these beautiful properties, basically a mansion. And so because Brian Sharples recently orchestrated a merger with Expedia for HomeAway for $3.9 billion, and this just happened right before the new year. He is now focusing, I know, really, serious money. So he's focusing his attention now on Twyla and leveraging those relationships that he has with these homeowners to essentially afford us these walls to install our limited editions. So that's basically, you know, the great divider is that unlike these other solely internet-based, you know, art firms, we have access to physical walls in really beautiful domestic spaces, shared spaces. So like the South Congress Hotel, you know, they have a wonderful lobby, bar, gift shop, you name it. And we're finding that our target demographic, like these are the venues they frequent socially. And so this way our work is already in their immediate vicinity.
I like that.
There is a saying that we throw around in the company, and it's essentially that, you know, there's still three things that you have to experience in person, and that's food, sex, and art. So for us, we want to be able to provide the art so that you can see it, view it in person before, you know, committing to it. But also we want to provide this platform for artists to really let their personalities shine, because there's still this sort of veil of secrecy between the artist and the collector. You know, and the gallerist is usually like that intermediary. So we're essentially replacing like the dealer with mobile technology that allows the viewer to connect directly with the artist.
Well, I like that. So let's go over that phrase again. So there are three things that you need to see in person, and that's food, sex, and art.
Experience in person. Yeah, absolutely.
Experience them in person.
You know,
right.
Not everything can be virtual, so there's still, like, something left to actual experiential enjoyment, you know?
No, I agree, and that's such an interesting issue because, you know, I've heard curators say that to me. I've heard, you know, I think Chrissy Isles was the one who said, you know, don't trust a JPEG, and, you know, something like that. And she was sort of saying, like, you know, people send me art, but she said, you know, you don't really know what it's like until you see it, you know? I mean, especially when everything on the computer gets reduced to such a small size. So in this case, people get a chance to actually experience it before they buy it?
Absolutely. Well, because it's already populating these shared collective spaces. And, you know, we're just finding that having worked in so many galleries in my career so far, you know, I started at Kagosi and then I moved to Berlin. I worked for a number of galleries there. came back to New York, moved to Aspen. I really loved my gallery in Aspen 212. It was a really great experience. And it was wonderful mostly because we had constant traffic. And the traffic, you know, it becomes this, like, extended family. Like, our collectors were definitely more than just clients to me. So that being said, though, when you leave sort of a community like Aspen, it's hard to maintain the frequency of, you know, visitors to your actual physical space. So a way to sort of circumvent that, because everyone's so busy now, you know, gallery attendance for a lot of galleries is difficult to maintain. This way, we just feel that if we help become the conduit to bring the art immediately to the viewer in a space where they already are going, you know, like Soho House, for example, that's a perfect example. And what they've done with artists is so smart. I think Francesca Gavin is absolutely a top curator. I love her vision. But it's fun for me because I feel like up until recently, a job like what I have now didn't really exist in the art world. And the art world can be a very sort of exclusionary place if you don't have, like, the right education, according to certain people. But I've always been in the commercial sector, and I'm very happy to work for profit because artists really need money to create and keep going, you know?
So that's true. And part of the way this will work, and I'd like to talk a little bit about also your career and your trajectory, which you went through in about 30 seconds in the art world. It was traveling all over the place. But in this paradigm that you're working on, will artists be able to reach out directly to the company and submit works for your
Absolutely.
Interest?
Absolutely. We're definitely, you know, we want to build community. And so even though it's a curated platform, myself and Heidi Lee Camaroni, an advisor based in New York and the Hamptons, the two of us are building the program currently, but, you know, we're hoping to have about 200 artists on the platform. Right now, I think we have probably just under 50. So we're building it very quickly. We had our initial preview at Art Basel Miami in the bungalow at the W Hotel, and that was fabulous. We had 20 different artists represented on the walls. It was a really great you know, community building exercise, and mostly for investors. So now we're ready to bring our work to the public, and that'll be happening mostly concentrated initially in Austin, but then growing out to LA, New York, and other, you know, quote, target markets.
That's exciting. And so to move back a little bit, when you kind of zoom through all of this, let's go back just for a second to the beginning of your involvement in the art world, because you talked about, you know, working in galleries all over the place. Did it start off that way when you came out of school? What were you
So I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, and Middlebury is very much a language. They have a very strong language program. So I majored in German and art. And after graduation, I miraculously was hired to work at Gagosian on West 24th Street in Chelsea, and it was probably the best first job that you could ask for in the art world. The people that I met were amazing. You know, they're all incredibly, like, international and sophisticated and, you know, clearly, obviously very successful. So unfortunately, it wasn't necessarily the venue that I felt, you know, my priorities were best expressed. So after a year and a half, I kind of decamped Berlin. And I opened the flagship gallery.
And before you go on to Berlin, though, but before you go on to Berlin, so what were you doing as your first job, which is pretty cool to be a Gagosian? What were you doing there?
My parents were they're so skeptical. So my job, I assisted, like, a number of the senior dealers, but mostly I was working with photographers. So working with Alex Sose, who I just adore. I think he's wonderful. Roger Ballen, Vera Luter, Taryn Simon, Sally Mann, you know, a whole slew of, like, really exceptional artists. But, you know, after, like, a few months, then I brought in and I was helping with Cecily Brown's account, you know, Jeff Koons. So, yeah, it was an immediate, you know, sort of like diving into the pool rather than taking the step, if you know what I mean.
And then after that, so then you left Gagosian and you went to Berlin?
I did, because I met through friends Robert Goss, who's now at David Warner, and Kathy Rosenthal. They had a gallery in Chelsea, Goss and Rosenthal, and I set up their flagship Berlin gallery, which was really a roller coaster. It was absolutely the best decision I ever made.
So wait a minute, before you go into that, you set up their flagship gallery. That's kind of a big deal. You went from, like, a school where, you know, you weren't necessarily studying, you know, what now would be, I guess, curatorial studies or something like that, and you got a job at Gagosian, and now you're helping someone set up a gallery. That sounds like a big jump.
Well, what happened is they, you know, I was just out at drinks with this girl, Yulia, who now is with Artsy, and she's fabulous. We were like, Yulia, how's work going? And she said, oh, you know, it's a little stressful because we're looking for an American who speaks German, who wants to move to Berlin and open our gallery in like 3 months. And I just looked at her and I was like, it's me. It was so ironic because, you know, speaking German fluently is this very random thing that I just happened to do because I went to Middlebury and that was my major. And I studied abroad in Berlin for a year when I was at Middlebury and fell in love with the city. I don't really feel like I tapped into the community there. At that time, I was a little too fresh, a little naive. I was a little intimidated. And so I went back the second time, you know, do it right. And it was really the best decision I ever made. I eventually, like, recruited, you know, my best friend from Gagosian, Erna Erickson. She's now at Hauser & Wirth. She came and lived in Berlin for several years, worked at Haunch, you know, did a huge Damien Hirst show. Like, it was really, like, a laboratory. She and I also, that's where we really started to curate in earnest in these alternative venues. So, you know, old breweries, old Hungarian cultural centers on, like, Alexanderplatz, very Sputnik sort of, you know, space odyssey kind of spaces. We did a few tape modern shows, and those were great. There was this old sort of like warehouse that was also a nightclub. And, you know, in your 20s, there's no better way to experiment than to just show up and do it and make mistakes and learn from them and, you know, find your voice as a curator because everyone is, you know, entitled to their own vision. And I think that it was like really necessary for me to have those like 6 years in Berlin, you know, to establish my curatorial voice.
That's pretty cool. And that was a time in Berlin when, as I remember, it was becoming kind of the hot spot then. It was,
or
maybe it already was, but that wasn't that when everything was kind of building or
that was the thing, you know, all these galleries kind of looked to Berlin as this like center of cultural production. And it's certainly true. It was then, it still is. You know, unfortunately, I would say the market there couldn't really support the influx of galleries that happened. It was like Yablanka moved in, Haunch of Venison moved in, like we moved in, Perez Projects moved in, everyone moved to Berlin. And I think, you know, there was this sense that it was going to become almost like the Chelsea, you know, what Chelsea is to New York for the art world. It was going to be like the Chelsea of like the international art scene. And it still is for artists. But I think galleries struggled there to maintain, you know, the sales necessary to, you know, keep the space. And it's really cheap there, but still, you know, if the market locally can't support you, then you end up doing a lot of art fairs and it's exhausting and it's not really sustainable for a small gallery that's not, you know, a massive conglomerate like a Swerner or Spruce Magers, for example.
Right. And that makes sense because, yeah, New York does have this. It was just an advisor I was talking to recently that was saying she felt that New York was currently the center of the art world, and the reason she felt that was, she said, because of the sheer buying power in New York.
Yeah. It's a hard fact to rectify. You know, I really, well, what I felt, so after living in Berlin for some time, and I had met all these amazing artists, and, you know, I really educated myself there by writing a lot, publishing. I was fortunate enough to write for the New York Times while I lived there. And so when I moved back to America, I really felt like it was time for me to move somewhere where maybe there was some money. So I moved to Aspen.
Right, and that is where there's a lot of money.
You know,
so,
I was
so,
sort
so,
of like,
so,
okay.
So what happened in Aspen? Because there's
Aspen
major galleries.
Yeah, Aspen has this unbelievable museum that is, it just reopened, actually, 2 years ago, their new space. It's huge, massive, it's wonderful. It was the architect of Shear Dupont. You know, he won the Pritzker Award. He's a lot of humanitarian architecture. And their director in Aspen of the museum, Heidi Zuckerman, she is tour de force. She's a very good friend. I mean, she's definitely, you know, I would like to call her my mentor. I really, really admire her. And she just built this museum into a really extraordinary venue and institution. It's not a collecting museum, so it's more like a Kunsthalle, actually. But they brought such great artists to town. And because sort of the community there is quite small, you know, there's really this feeling of intimacy. When the artists come, you really get to know them. It's not like in New York, you know, where the museums are still the geschlossene Gesellschaft, as the Germans say, sort of like private party. You know, there it felt very, very much more open. So getting to Aspen itself is difficult enough, you know.
Right. And so how was the experience there? You were there for how long?
So I was there for 2.5 years, and I absolutely loved it. Really, really liked the other dealers that I met there, like Richard Edwards, the Baldwin Gallery. They have a stellar program. They do such an amazing job. he and his staff are just wonderful. And I'd actually initially met him in Berlin, so he was just, like, completely shocked when I showed up at his gallery, and I was like, no, I live here now. And it was fun, you know, it was definitely beautiful, and, like, obviously the scenery there is just magnificent. So it was unfortunate that I had to leave due to family circumstances, but now I live in Pittsburgh, where I was born and raised, and I have to say Pittsburgh is also having a bit of a renaissance right now, culturally speaking, so I feel very, in a sense, strangely blessed that I'm back in my hometown at this particular point in time, because Pittsburgh is going to make its mark since, like, mark my words, time.
Really? So tell me, what is happening in Pittsburgh? Because I remember hearing a lot about Pittsburgh, you know, not long ago, and what is happening there? Why is it going through a renaissance?
Oh, I can tell you why. It's really good.
It was actually, the stars are aligning.
Dwayne
Michaels. I think it was Dwayne Michaels who mentioned it to me, the photographer who lived there, mm-hmm. and went back there and wrote a book about it and said it's amazing there. So, yeah, tell me.
Okay, well, first of all, the important thing to know about Pittsburgh is that when Pittsburgh was originally settled by the French, the name of the city in French was like the Belle of the Three Rivers. Okay, and then William Pitt came and settled it, and they renamed it Pittsburgh. So that essentially messed up, like, RPR as a city for, like, you know, generations. Pittsburgh is beautiful. It's got more bridges than Venice. And what we also have is this wonderful history and legacy of philanthropy, especially cultural philanthropy. So, you know, the Carnegie Museum is absolutely killer, the quote biennial. The Carnegie International is this really wonderful exhibition. They bring in top curators for that. And we have the Warhol Museum. Eric Schneider, the director there, is just a genius. We have the Mattress Factory, which is this funky installation museum. And they were showing, Chiharu Shiota, who just represented Japan in the Venice Biennale this past time, to rave reviews. They were showing her like 15 years ago. So they were really cutting edge. Like, all, you know, they have a permanent Kusama Infinity Room installation. They have a permanent James Turrell installation. And this is what I grew up in high school visiting on the weekends, you know, with these types of exhibitions, not even realizing, you know, how sort of like fundamentally groundbreaking they were in that context. I remember I got to meet Kusama in her installation when I was like a junior in high school. And it's so amazing now to see, you know, what's happened in the interim there. She's really a legend. So I'm very fortunate in that way. But, okay, so what happened in Pittsburgh is we have Carnegie Mellon University. And this is one of the top technical, you know, technology schools in the country. Like, you know, it's just behind, like, MIT. But what was happening is all of these incredibly brilliant people were coming to study at CMU, and then they would graduate and they would leave. And they would go to Silicon Valley or wherever. So what's happening now is now Pittsburgh has Uber. Facebook is opening offices there. We have Google headquarters there as well. So all of this, what the brain drain was doing before to Pittsburgh was taking all of our, you know, intellectuals away, and now they're all staying. So there was like a collapse in the economy, like the year I was born when the steel industry, you know, sort of fell apart. So the real estate is incredibly affordable. I shouldn't even be saying this. It's a great place to live, and culturally it's incredibly vibrant. So, you know, now's the time.
Wow, that's exciting. Yeah, I've never been to Pittsburgh, I'm sorry to say, but that sounds
have to come and let me know, and you can stay with me because I have a 3-story, like, 5-bedroom house, and it costs less than a studio apartment in Brooklyn.
Wow. That sounds
it's
a little
like
bit
this
like
historical, like, Victorian with, like, you know, stained glass. And I mean, it's really amazing. So that's what Pittsburgh really has to offer, because it's an old town, you know, so it has history, and the architecture is really great. It's really interesting visually. Yeah, the urban landscape there is something extraordinary.
That is cool. Well, that's exciting, and it's great to hear about all of this. And maybe in closing, we should talk a little bit about if you want to say something to this, because you're working with artists all the time, and there's a lot of artists as well as curators, of course, listening to this show. Is there, because we are entering kind of a new age with this, with the company that you're working with and everything else, in terms of distribution of the arts and the artist's place in this whole solar system of business, is there anything you want to say to artists in terms of accessing that system?
I do. I mean, I think that ultimately what's really important is that artists shouldn't be afraid to get as much exposure for themselves and for their art as they can. You know, there's something about, like, the this like secrecy quotient and this like scarcity quotient, the rarity. You know, we're in a society now where information is being disseminated on like a scale we've never seen before, and in many ways this is great for artists. So, you know, for me, you're aware of this, and, you know, a lot of my close friends are. Like, I moved home to Pittsburgh because my mother has terminal brain cancer, and so I've been surrounded essentially by death and disease for the past 6 months. And in that context, when you look at artists and what they create, you really come to understand, like, how absolutely imperative their work is, you know, to revitalize the human spirit in the face of, like, such awful kind of sobering tragedy. So, you know, ultimately, it's like, I think because when you work in the arts, you're sort of inundated and oversaturated, you know, with these visuals and images on a daily basis. But, you know, for the majority of the population, like, that's not their everyday experience. And so artists are crucial, you know, to keeping humanity going in the right direction. So, like, all I want to say is, like, keep it up. You know, it's a tough job. Someone's got to do it, but it really makes such a massive difference to people. It really, you know, it's absolutely, you know, we want to empower the artists to spread their vision because it's uplifting and it's important.
And in terms of, I mean, I so agree with you. And also, you know, I'm so sorry to hear about your mother. And I mean, I knew that already, but that's very powerful to contrast that with the way art can fill us with, you know, the kind of life force or something like that, as well as the fact that artists should have exposure. And what you're saying, do you have any ideas of how, when you say artists should have as much exposure as possible, part of what artists are dealing with is how do they get all that exposure? And is it, do you have any thoughts on that? Is it just through group shows, pursuing galleries or pop-up spaces?
First of all, communication is the most important thing, and also community and collaboration. You know, like 10 voices are louder than one. And I've just seen, you know, different collectives come together and really come up together because they really support each other. They help each other out. You know, they advocate for each other. And, you know, there's power in numbers. So I think that, you know, there's this token sort of vision of the artist is this like, struggling soul, kind of, you know, visionary, locked away alone, working on their craft. But ultimately, it's really collaboration and community that, you know, helps people succeed. And Carson Chan, who's a friend of mine, he's a PhD candidate in the architecture program at Princeton, a wonderful curator, did like the Biennial of the Americas in Denver last year, and, you know, the fourth Marrakesh Biennial. Like Carson always says, when my friends succeed, I succeed. And that's just a philosophy that I think everyone should really embrace.
I like that. Emily, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much. Really, it's an honor. Seriously, it's been an honor. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.